Hey everyone, this is Sarah, and welcome to my show. Hey everybody, Sarah here, and I'm back. So I want to tell you a story, okay? So as you know, I have a million kids, and one of my kids recently got, I guess for lack of a better word, kicked out of daycare. You know, like, I mean, I don't know if any of you have had this experience with like a school or a daycare or whatever, but I went to pick him up and they were like, look, you know, he can't come back tomorrow. I mean, the place was kind of a zoo anyways. There were like 15 kids and wild music and they had a parakeet and it was really loud and I mean, everything. Okay. So truth be told, I was kind of glad to get him out of there. Anyways, it really wasn't a fit for him. But now here I am, you know me, working hard on my business, grinding every day, fully operational. And then now I have a four-year-old and nowhere to put my kid, right? And in addition, you know, I have my baby. I just had a baby, so I have my baby home with me. So, you know, needless to say, this was an abrupt transition, okay? The daycare just kind of being like, here's your kid back. You know, so there was no time to whine. I had to take action. So I called up this babysitter that, you know, I had kind of talked to before. And well, long story short, she's charging me $20 an hour. And I'm like, at first I'm like, oh my gosh, like this is so much compared to what the cost of daycare was. So, you know, I kind of got suckered into it, but I really didn't have any better options. So I'm like, okay, you know, I'll give it a try. Well, let me tell you, this is what I would term a luxury daycare service, okay? Like he gets fed, she does home-cooked meals, she reads with them, she writes, like she teaches him, doesn't have manners, you know, I as his mother am responsible for that really, but she reinforces, like he has even better manners than his manners now. So, you know, I feel like this has lived up to it. And that's actually exactly what I want to talk about today is the idea of creating a luxury brand, one that people will value and will pay for. But I think in our industry, we don't really have an understanding of what the identity of a luxury brand is. And I am so excited that I have Sebastian Dovey here with me.
Hey.
Hey, what's up, Seb?
Hey, thank you for having me.
So Seb was the co-founder and managing director of Scorpio Partnership. Even though, by the way, he's wrong with Scorpio, okay? That's not even his sign, so, but whatever, you know, despite breaking that rule, he named the company Scorpio Partnership. It is a wealth management consultancy that conducts research on the global wealth industry. And, I mean, I myself initially was, you know, came to Seb because of his very good and insightful research and, you know, have been very impressed. And in fact, he was so successful at his research, the company was acquired by Aon. And now he's involved with organizations at the board level. So this is a leader in our industry, someone who's, you know, has a lot of really smart things to say. So Seb, you've said before that the wealth management industry could learn a lot from the you're not arguing with that. No,
I'm not.
Doubt.
No, I'm gonna take every minute. I'm just smiling and staring into the distance. Keep going.
Right, okay. So you've said before that the wealth management industry could learn a lot from the luxury marketplace. I think that's interesting. In fact, when we were talking before the show, you said you'd love to see the CEO of like Ritz-Carlton or something run, you know, Morgan Stanley or one of these big brokerages or whatever. So, So tell me about that, first of all.
Well, I mean, it's a little bit like your story with the daycare. You know, I think we have to understand in society as much as in financial services, you know, what is a luxury? What constitutes luxury? And that has changed over centuries, right? I mean, way, way back, a luxury might have been the capacity to not have to work in the field or not to, you know, not to do a laboring job. And it was to do a thinking job, to be able to, you know, use your brain in a different way. And we've moved all the way up into more of a consumerist and financially driven society with money as a term. You know, what can money buy you that prevents you from having to do something yourself or that you can delegate to others? And that's one element of luxury. The other element of luxury is the experience. Is the experience going to be something that you just, you know, there's that beautiful phrase, which is something that sort of touches on luxury, which is that money can't buy. Now, obviously, money has to buy it. I mean, otherwise, it wouldn't probably happen in most cases, unless it's, of course, looking at a wonderful view or taking a great walk in the countryside and so on. But, you know, what can money buy that's luxury? And in financial services, probably at the apex of financial services from a private client or private client investor, is the services of wealth management, private banking. And I think our industry has drifted in over the last maybe decade or so into losing sight of what luxury is to the client, what luxury means in terms of what they're prepared to pay for, and what luxury means to them in terms of what they want to get from it. So that's why I sort of say, you know, we need to understand what luxury is, bring it back to our territory, and maybe to sort of electric shock the industry. Yes, bring in someone from Ritz-Carlton or, you know, one of the wonderful watch brands like Philippe or Cartier or something like that. But there's a question, I'm sure we'll get to it later, but you can get a little bit distracted by thinking it's all about luxury. It's also about delivery. The luxury industry does something fantastically well, which is they deliver the goods. You know, they make a promise and then you get that promise. Financial services, we may make promises, although there's lots of small fine print to say we're never really responsible for it, but always quite deliver. So that's where the tension is. But that's my opening remarks. And that's why I think, you know, when you said, well, God, I had to pay $20 for it, but wow, you know, I'm sold effectively. Well, your money bought something. Your money bought quality, assurance, an expectation of a positive outcome. And those are the things that we need to learn from and bring to wealth management and private banking. There you go. That's my opening shot.
Well, and it's really important too in terms of, you want your clients to feel like it's expensive but worth it.
Right, right. There was a phrase that one of my team used to use years ago. He said, you know, he's trying to give us some business advice. He said, you need to be reassuringly expensive. Now, I've started from the grassroots, self-made, and I'm never 100% comfortable with, you know, I don't think you should overprice. You should deliver what your value is. And but he sort of had a point, which is in the marketplace, there is a question of making sure that your price, if we're just focusing on that for a moment, is correctly positioned to reflect essentially the cost of delivery and also the value of that delivery to the person that's paying for it. You know, that's a perception issue. That's what I think I'm prepared to pay for. But crucially, you always have to make sure it's on that right on the right side of that line, which is it's not overcharged and then underdelivered.
But it's never going to be exact.
Like no, it's not going to be exact.
You're over or undercharge a lot of the time.
You are, but you see, that's where other elements in luxury come in. You know, for example, Ritz-Carlton. I mean, I could stay in a hotel right next door to the Ritz-Carlton and pay a tenth of the price. It could be called a Hilton Gardens Inn, to pick a brand. Or I could stay next door and, you know, I'd sleep the same way. I'd get the sort of primary outcome that I expected. But the experience that I'm having with the Ritz-Carlton, the connection to the brand, the connection to the certainty of what I'm going to get is going to be different. And I'm prepared to pay for that. It might be I'm also doing a trade-off. That's part of my life that I really want to pay for because that's what I, and this is crucial, that's what I value or enjoy. And maybe in another part of my life, you know, I'll drive a Subaru. I don't know. And it's the same application that should be put to financial services and particularly wealth management. Therefore, when I said we sort of drifted away from understanding the value of luxury and wealth management, I think we as an industry have got to a point where we almost just assumed that we were going to get the clients, that the clients, we are here, they have to use us. And in reality, they don't. They have choice and they're beginning to realize how they can exercise that choice by using multiple providers or going to another one. And so the competition has forced the industry to work out, well, why do they come to us? And what is it they're going to come to us? And what are they prepared to pay for what we deliver? And that's the battleground right now.
So if you think about somebody driving a Maserati, nobody's driving a Maserati out of necessity. It's a love kind of a purchase. But these
absolutely
okay. But it's not like in my case with the daycare where with the babysitter where it was like, I absolutely need this, you know.
Yeah.
This was not a necessity buy, okay? This was Maserati. Okay, no. But what luxury brands do really well is what you just said is they create an emotional connection to the brand. This is missing in financial services.
Well, it's not. I mean, there are emotional connections with brands in financial services. Some people are extremely passionate towards brands. Some of them are passionate in the wrong way, which is they're very anti the brands or anti the industry.
See, I've just seen it anti. So can you give me an example of people being passionate about a financial brand?
In a positive or a negative sense?
Positive. We all know the negative.
Okay. Well, I mean, look, in a positive sense, there's a huge amount of feedback. Whenever we used to do the business I had built, which was a customer insight business, so we listened to customers, got them to go for their kind of satisfaction scores of firms. The score ratings for satisfaction of wealth management private bankies were almost always 65% plus, so 65 to 85% plus. That doesn't compare by any stretch to most retail products. Most retail products are in a much lower band than a high touch business like a wealth management. There's also a pretty strong amount of following when you get people to talk about financial services brands. Take the startup world or the fintech world. There's a huge amount of positive aura that comes with those brands. Now, arguably they're disruptors, so maybe they're attacking the mainstream brand. But a lot of the work that I used to see of high net worths and ultra high net worths were very, very passionate about the service and the experience and the history. Those are three crucial words in making luxury that they had with whether it was JP Morgan or Citibank or any of the institutions of big brands. And by the way, just to take a data point, around about, of all of the wealth that was managed by the industry, 80%, just under 80%, was held by the top 20 global institutions. So there was a huge amount of concentration in big brands that delivered luxury. Now, you have to understand those 20 institutions would then have lots of private wealth brands, sub-brands within them to deliver their offer. But it's crucial that people are drawn to big institutions and are very, very passionately in favor of them most of the time.
That's interesting.
I've stunned you into silence. I think maybe, have I not achieved a first? I've managed to put Sarah Griller into a stunned silence on a podcast.
Done. Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, I think you, because you have this consumer insights business, you obviously, we're in the business of speaking with high net worth, ultra high net worth people all day. And so, I mean, you have more insight as to what people, you've seen this emotional connection to the JP Morgan right. private bank, whereas me, not as much. So right. tell me what else, what are other three, like what are more takeaways that you learned? Give me a few more about right. wealthy people right. and how they think and behave about this industry that you learned from your consumer insights business.
I loved your reaction because your reaction is very consistent. And that's as an entrepreneur, when you're onto a good thing, when you get the opposite side of the table, kind of hesitate and go, because that means it's a moment where there's an opportunity to try and develop something. And that's essentially where we started with Scorpio Partnership, because when we first set the business up, we sat back and we thought, look, what does everyone talk about when they talk about wealth? They assume these people are another sort of species and they're uncontactable and they've done amazing things that, they're just another orbit and there's no way of,
They're greedy. People say the stereotype. Wealthy people are greedy.
Well,
by the way, I don't believe that personally, but
not at all. I mean, certainly, look, the media coverage in general, and this is not a piece on media, but if you're trying to get attention, you will go to the extremes. I used to be a journalist, so I know. You're trying to get something that's going to capture up audience interest. Talking about the average is not interesting. Talking about the extremes is. And in wealth management, everyone, the high net worth, ultra high net worth, it was always about, what have the Rockefellers done, or what have the Rousings done, or look at Paris Hilton. And in reality, there are thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, even millions of people that are, very fortunate to have made some substantial amount of money by any definition of population in terms of wealth control. They happen to also need financial services, consumer services, so with banks. So that's why when we started, we thought, why don't we spend time understanding what they want, this audience? Let's listen to them. Let's learn what they want. Very much the same as a watchmaker might want to do it, or a luxury goods in terms of clothes or a car. All those sectors listen to clients, learn from clients, and develop products for clients. Our industry, financial services industry, just assumed, well, because we're the bank, they have to use us, so we don't need to listen to them. This was back in the 90s. Now, fast forward 25 years, and obviously that's kind of at the center. Listen to clients. There's a day that goes by without some CEO saying, I'm a client-centric business and wealth management. So that's the move forward. Now, what you asked, which was other examples of takeaways. I think the takeaway is that luxury is both a positive and a negative from a strategic perspective. There are firms that have said, we want to be luxury. And so then, and then they would say, we want to be like the Cartier of wealth management. And, you know, so we've got to be this. And they almost think everything has to be handcrafted. Everything has to be hand-stitched. But they have to remember that Cartier or Patek Philippe or any type of example of that, they're only making maybe 1,000 product a year in a specific line or 10,000. They're not making something that's replicable at scale. This is an industry, wealth management, which is much, much bigger than that. You can't just do everything hand-stitched. You could never afford to do it. And in reality, the takeaway from the clients that we dealt with when it comes to financial services, the things that they thought were most luxurious, consistency. So I get what I expect on time when I want it. And consistency in terms of the information that I receive, in terms of the outcomes that I get, in terms of my money management, or I just know it's there. And that is a luxury in so much of life where it's very volatile. That's something that many people worth paying for. It's a little bit like your daycare, you know, that you knew that the quality of the person in front of you, they would just deliver. They also want credibility. That was a big, big one. So they want to know that the decision that they made to choose JP Morgan, Citibank, or, you know, you choose it, Hightower, it doesn't really matter, that there was a good decision and that the good decision in their money management would help them with their ambitions on their money, but also it just made them feel good. You know, it's nice to know that you're doing business with a good business. I mean, who wants to be doing business with a bad business? And so credibility is the other piece, the consistency and credibility. And then the last one, which is the one where the industry really falls short. And I my reason for this, you know, in terms of why it's being asked for by clients, is because the clients are very aware. They're paying the price of a Maserati for the financial services that they get relative to firms. They want creativity. They want firms to go, you know what, Sarah, we know all about you. And based on what you are and based on the money that you have, we think that you should dot, dot, dot. And you're like, yes, that's it. That's exactly what I wanted to know. That's how I feel I should be engaged with. And so this creativity is the alpha of a relationship, but it's not delivered. Most banks sort of fall short on that, where they think creativity is, have I got another structured product for you? You know, it isn't just about the products. It's about
You could buy an equity linked index, our new one.
Yeah, I mean, that's not, I mean, that might be creativity from financial engineering, but to the end customer, you know, it's things like.
Give me a few more examples. Because I actually have written about this before. I think that in general, the model of people having hundreds of clients and running around with their hair on fire is really going to get people into a lot of trouble in the future with investment management becoming more commoditized. I think you've got to really fight for the value. And the way that you do this is by having deep, deep relationships with fewer clients. And so naturally, those clients are going to have to be luxury consumers. They're going to have to be the ultra high net worth or high net worth people with 2 million, 3 million. You've got to get into the bigger portfolios, the bigger, you know, investors with more sophisticated needs. And so I want to know, I have my own ideas about this, but I want to know from you, what do these people perceive as being a creative, or I hate the term outside the box, because it's like such an inside the box phrase. It's such a cliche.
Well, I mean, I'll probably take a little bit of issue with your assumption, because my consistency and credibility and creativity, I deliberately don't mention it's about just people, because there is an assumption that the only way that you can deliver that is by, you know, high contact, you know, high personal contact. And, you know, on one level, yeah, of course, you can deliver consistency, credibility, and creativity if you do it on a one-to-one basis with a person. But running a global business, or even a local or national business, a business one, that is unsustainable. I mean, you just can't get enough people
hard
to build
to scale.
The business
itself. Right.
But the reality is, another piece of the customer research was these customers, and I use the word delivery customers rather than clients, even though they're worth tens of millions of dollars, or even millions of dollars, or even hundreds of thousands of dollars, are very aware of what's luxury to them and the buying power, but they don't necessarily mind not having time with a person. They do like having time with a person when it's specifically relevant to their needs. But the rest of the time, they would happily have it. And this was a challenge for the industry in the 2000s, because the wealthiest people were saying, we happily have a remote digital engagement. In fact, you could make that digital engagement is almost more valuable to me, and it can deliver consistency, credibility, and creativity as if I had to sit in front of, you know, Seb Dovey relationship manager. It doesn't need to be personally manually delivered. This was the same discovery, by the way, at LVMH, because they thought for a long time that the only way that they could have a luxury business was to have, you know, hand stitched all the time.
And then by LVMH, you mean Louis Vuitton.
Louis Vuitton. But then they discovered mass customization, right? They discovered a market of customers across a much wider spectrum that were prepared to pay for parts of their service or parts of their products, not the hand stitch. They knew that if you wanted hand stitch, if I want time with the CEO of a private bank, I know that has a price. But I can pay for that separately. I don't need to have it as part of my base package. So actually, we're going into a world now where I think the industry of wealth management is beginning to understand, wait a second, we've got to understand what our price point is just for the people we put in front of our clients, because we've also got a price point for the digital experience that we deliver to the clients. Collectively, they can give us consistency, credibility, and creativity, but they don't have to be all wrapped into a single price point.
Mm-hmm.
I've stunned you again. I'm doing really well, actually. I'm enjoying this in England. I'm kind of putting Sarah right into the silent zone.
So on that subject, how have you seen these luxury financial, well, maybe not even financial, but just in general, mm-hmm. how luxury brands connect with their consumers digitally? And do you think wealth management is ahead or behind?
Wealth management's catching up, but it's still behind. You know, I think the luxury goods industry had the same emotional anxiety about switching to a digital environment. You know, is this going to dilute the essence of our brand? Is it going to dilute the quality of our products lines? You know, just and all of the other pieces. But in the last decade, if you look at any of the digital experiences of the high-end brands, and I'm not just picking clothes brands, but any high-end brands, or car brands, for example, the digital experience of what you can do online as a consumer, it's not just for information, but you can consume, you purchase, you can design, you can create, you can engage with the product line of the luxury brand that you want to go to. So if I wanted a specific type of watch from a very specialist provider of watches, I could go online and effectively custom build what I wanted. They'd take the order, go away, go back to the shop and build. Of course, I'd then pay $50,000 for it because that was the ticket price. But interestingly, I'd pay for that online too. Not once did I have to go into a physical outlet in order to do that. Now that presupposes that I know the brand. That presupposes that I've engaged with the brand history. But those brands I'm describing, like cars and stuff, they're working really hard to connecting with the consumer audience in many different ways than historical, to just get that message across that, you know, we're there, we can tailor for you, we can build for you, but you can engage on our shop site in a virtual context. Wealth management's really, really struggled to do that. It's been sort of, to some extent, hostage to its principal revenue model, which is the salesperson. Which is, you know, I suppose turkeys don't post for Christmas. It's very difficult to say to a salesperson, we're going to change, the way that a customer engages. And people misunderstand whenever I used to say that thing, well, you're trying to destroy the essence of our model. I'm not. I'm trying to keep the essence of our business up to date with where customers are going. I think that the role of the individual salesperson is going to remain. They just have to change. They have to adapt to the environment they're in order to succeed.
Oh, but you know, rich people don't use the internet, so financial advisors can't reach.
I could say, oh, that's nonsense.
that's what they all say.
I don't think they do now. Actually, there's enough research now and enough businesses in traveling the direction to acknowledge, you know, what was obvious to us about 20 years ago. I mean, the wealthiest people tend to buy technology first, right? So they're engaged with technology. They're the first sort of, you know, technical adopters of anything, really, because that's when it's most expensive. So they were online and interfacing online and sharing data online far, far earlier than the financial services industry, understood.
What's crucial is they accepted it more.
Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
But I hear, you understand, like I help advisors with digital marketing and I hear like 90 times a day, but mm-hmm.
My clients don't do this. Yeah.
Clients aren't, they don't use LinkedIn. They're not on social media. Yeah. I have to send them a paper newsletter in the mail because they don't check their email. Like, this is but I, you know, Seb, I obviously doubt it.
It's a source of intelligence. Yeah, you know, I mean, we've heard it for many years. And look, I have a huge amount of respect for all people that are dealing with end customers. But, you know, the body of knowledge, the direction of travel of consumers, whether it's in financial services or non-financial services matters, is definitely in a digital direction. And, you know, the individual salespersons that, I've been in those conversations, and I've listened to a lot of private wealth managers in more than 35 different countries, tell me the same thing. But then I would say to them, well, yeah, how well do you really know your customer? Because if I took you to the same
customer,
I could guarantee that they're probably going to have five applications in front of them in terms of technical connection. They are going to be using the internet in ways, but, you know, maybe it's you that hasn't adjusted.
That's right.
And that's the challenge. The challenge is that the sales force is currently has to up its game. It has to recognize that it's using digital not to replace it, but to augment it. And that's the change. That's the real game changer. The best relationship managers I've met have understood how technology augments them.
Let me tell you a story. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I have this one client who calls on tech executives. And I don't mean the tech executive that's like the middle manager. I mean the tech executive that founded a company, grew it to 50 people, and now it's been bought and it's gone public. Okay. So and we've been calling on them using LinkedIn. And these are ultra high net worth. Like, these people have $50 million net worth, okay? Mm-hmm. And they're all on LinkedIn. Like, every single one, there's not a single one of them that you cannot reach on LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. So I totally believe your point. And I've said this to, now, this is not the only client that is calling on these tech entrepreneurs, okay? I have this one client that was open to using technology, but then I have other clients that also want to reach these prospects, but do not believe in LinkedIn, do not believe in social media, do not believe in technology as the way to communicate, and they're not reaching them.
Yep.
Like, I could wash, rinse, and repeat with like 50 other people with $50 million of net worth.
Yeah.
But I'm not doing it because I have this one client that apparently is like the only one who believes that ultra high net worth people know how to use the internet.
Well, and for that individual, it's happy days because it's the ignorance of many in the market to not think that people are not technologically astute. And, you know, are not thinking of ways of using digital and technology more broadly to improve their lives. I think what it does move towards is a bigger issue, which is we need to understand as an industry how to reach out to our audience. We need to connect to them potentially in a different way. Our expectation that they would come to us just because is not going to hold up for much longer. So the power of the brand, the power of marketing, the power of connecting to the world of people, you know, using technology, digital, social, even more conventional. There are firms I know that are doing very well that are using post and sending out mail and hard copy because it captures people's attention and it's crucial. I don't care, in a sense, as a former business owner in this space, however you do it, you need to do it well, which is connect to your clients. And that's whatever means you use. And we've now, in the last decade and a half, been given a new means to connect them. But it's not the only means. So the big message I always try to get across to our industry is stay at least on pace with your customer behavior and habits and needs. Don't expect. And if you fall behind, have the humility to work out a way to catch up by listening around you. A lot of firms that I've seen just go, wow, you know, Seb, Sarah, you simply don't understand, you know, you've not been in front of a client. I've met more clients than most firms have ever dealt with. You know, but I'm a consumer understander, if you will. I haven't got the single answer, but I've watched behavior. And through watching behavior, you can develop solutions that will work for some. You can never assume you're going to get all your clients, but you will work for some. And that's a good thing.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen it really work nicely. See, when people think, oh, you know, how do you get clients from a technology application, how do you get them over the internet? It's not literal. You're not getting, the client is not meeting you on Facebook and then going to your website and signing up on the website necessarily. Mm. I mean, that might be the case. You're connecting there, and then you take, it can work so beautifully, so very beautifully, to take the relationship offline and then back online. And it, because what you're doing is you're giving them a choice for how they want to be communicated with.
And that's,
they might not
the
always
change.
Want the phone call. Do you ever get mad when your phone rings? Admit it. The honest.
I have a confession to make, which is I've had my phone. The best outcome I ever had was when I was given a mobile phone and I learned the silent button, and that was in 99. I've had my phone on silent for 20 years. It's brilliant.
I have mine on vibrate, and it's because I have four kids under six, so I need to. Like, I need to know when it rings, but I don't need the whole, like, flourish of the, you know, national anthem is the ringtone, you know, but. I get mad when the phone rings sometimes. When I'm trying to do, I'll admit it, everybody. When I'm trying to do something, like write a blog, I get mad when my phone rings. I would much rather prefer a text message. I'm always on my computer, email, LinkedIn, instant messenger. I love, like, I get angry when the phone rings. Don't call me. I really don't want anyone to call me unless you're my client and we have our weekly scheduled meeting and something happened. Or if you're my daycare or my kid's doctor, or if you're Antonio, that the kids are at the park and something happened. Like, that's the only one, my parents, my brother, that's the only one I want to hear from on the phone.
But you see, I think that's an interesting societal change, you know, from the introduction of when the phone first came. The idea that the phone would ring was a sort of celebrated status thing. You know, you had a phone and it rang for you. That made you very important. And nowadays, it's about the quantum of messaging that you get, which makes you important, or how you're connected to the world in terms of what forms of connection you have, whether it's social or non-social. All of these things are important in terms of understanding how customers, how individuals engage with the other side, i.e. the sellers, the vendors, the connectors. And these are sociological, psychological, behavioral, but they're fundamentally all bound in our world, boil down to how people consume. And private banking or wealth management, its biggest error in terms of staying on pace with the race was for about from 98 till really 2008, 2009 with crisis, just didn't think that their market behaved like consumers. They thought their market was completely different. And I spent a long time when we were building the business having to say to them, I cannot understand why you're doing this, because they are consumers. Fortunately, from 2008 to 2019, today, we have got that, but we've now got to play catch up with our audience and with our competitors to work it. I'm excited for the next 10 years because I think we're going to do some pretty great things in wealth management, private bank, from what I can see. I just think they lost time. They lost 10 years relative to the luxury goods world and just retail.
Well, what I think, and the recent incident with Ken Fisher, actually, not that I want to go back over that, you know, I have opinions about this, but that actually, to me, has really been eye-opening because it's made me think about what the future of the industry is, and the industry's reaction to this and the outrage actually has made me kind of optimistic. And so going forward, I see actually a brighter future in terms of leaders coming into power in our industry that maybe have a little bit more ethics and that are a little bit more tolerant. I don't see a great appetite for tolerating injustices socially, you know, and politically in our industry, and this is something new. This I have to thank Alex Tulakian because you know, he really brought to light a lot, and I think this actually is a great indication of what the future may behold. Not that I'm that optimistic, but I gotta admit,
well, you have to be. There's a lovely quote of an inventor I always used to do. You say it to keep me sane, which he said, you know, I'm interested in the future because I plan to spend the rest of my life there. And I always thought that was a really, really nice way of looking up. There's a Charlie Chaplin quote that I also use sometimes to just keep me going, which says, you know, you'll never see the rainbow if you keep looking at your shoes. And so But those are the things that keep me smiling and keep me optimistic. But I do think that the industry, you know, will we in the next decade? I was asked to give a forecast of that recently, what will happen in the next decade. I do think that there will be a CEO that comes from another industry sector, like, you know, the luxury hotels or luxury goods, but actually really then does make a transformational difference to the market space. I do see, you know, a fintech actually becoming a mainstream tech operator, in the sense that it's a recognized wealth provider that can sit directly alongside competing with, you know, a brands that I've named before, like a JP Morgan or a Citi, you know, that they will be seen on par with that. You know, and I do see actually the change in the way that people pay for wealth management. I think that in the future, we will probably pay less in absolute terms for what we used to get, because it's more delivered, but I think we'll be paying for it on a more of a subscription basis, you know, where it's not linked just purely to our assets, but it's based on the customer saying, I know this is a good thing. I need to have a line into a financial services provider to do all sorts of things for me. I'll pay for that on a monthly rate, similar to if I was at, and this is where the industry will kind of choke on their caviar, but, you know, similar to going to the gym.
Yeah, definitely choke on the caviar there. Okay, so I always like to end things with the bang. So, Seb, thank you.
Pleasure.
You know, Seb's on LinkedIn. Are you open to connecting with people, or do you want nobody to bother you?
I love talking to people. I have one genetic weakness, I think, and it's probably not genetic, but just behavioral weakness, which is I struggle to say no. I love being able to solve people's problems. And, you know, now that I've had the privilege of being able to build a business and with my partner and wife exit, yeah, no, look, I'm very happy. I think anyone that can provide challenging riddles that allow us all to sit back and use our brain. I'll do one last philosopher quote, which is Paul Tracy, who said, "The greatest single source of wealth is what's between your ears." So by all means, do get in touch.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So I'm going to put Seb's LinkedIn in the show notes. And Seb, thank you so much for your time. Wonderful conversation. Everybody, please subscribe, rate, and review this podcast.
Yay. All right. All the best, guys. Thank you.
All right.